Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's program. This is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and the program is Update on Lymphoma Treatment from the 2010 American Society of Hematology, or ASH, Annual Meeting. And I know many of you have waited for this call, and here it is, and we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. Now, we have also a number of other organizations that have helped to promote the program, and we have on the call today over 1,622 participants on the call. And you do come from all regions of the United States. And we also have representatives from 49 countries worldwide listening in on the program today. So this is truly a global call. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about the program itself, our speakers, what they're going to cover, and there also is information about all of the different resources that you can access for help, and of course, there's an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us topics, what you'd like us to do, and I have to say, by far, this topic is one that we hear from all of you over and over again. Please do this every year, and we have been doing this every year. So keep telling us what you want us to do, and we'll very much try to do it. This program today is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Cephalon Oncology, Genentech, BioIgen, IDEC, and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company. And we really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, just an amazing group of speakers, and I want to introduce to you our speakers. Our first speaker, actually, is Dr. Oliver Press. Dr. Press is member Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, recipient Dr. Penny E. Peterson Memorial Chair for Lymphoma Research, professor of medicine, University of Washington, co-chair NCI Lymphoma Steering Committee. Dr. Press wears many hats, and he is going to start off by presenting to all of you an overview of lymphoma and how research and clinical trials influence treatment options. Dr. Press?
Yes, my mission today is to provide a brief overview of the standard therapies for the common types of lymphomas, and this will serve as a framework for you to understand the new advances that are then going to be presented by my colleagues. As most of you know, lymphoma is a cancer of the immune system, and the immune system is made up of cells called lymphocytes, which are made either in the bone marrow, called B lymphocytes or B cells, or in the thymus gland, called T cells or T lymphocytes. Lymphomas currently afflict about 74,000 Americans every year, and there are currently about 500,000 Americans living with lymphoma. There are many different mutations in B and T cells that can lead to lymphomas, and in fact, we now recognize more than 60 different kinds of lymphomas. And so it's very important to think about the type you have when considering therapy, because some of these are fast-growing, some are slow-growing, there are different treatment regimens that are used, different survival rates, and so knowing the type of lymphoma is very important. That's generally established by doing a lymph node biopsy and looking at it under the microscope, and after the diagnosis is made by the lymph node biopsy, then a workup is done to determine how far the lymphoma has spread. And that so-called staging workup involves a multitude of blood tests, scans like CAT scans and PET scans, a bone marrow biopsy usually, and at the end of that process, we know how far the lymphoma has spread and divide patients into one of four stages. In order to select treatment for a patient, a doctor needs to know then both the type of lymphoma and the stage in order to select treatment. There are four basic types of treatments that are currently available for lymphoma. The first is chemotherapy. The second is radiation therapy. Third are immunotherapy, such as monoclonal antibodies. And fourth are biologic agents, I'll call them, or pathway inhibitors. I'm now going to describe the standard of care for five of the most common types of lymphomas in order to provide a framework, as I mentioned earlier. And the first type I'll talk about is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is an aggressive lymphoma that's the most common lymphoma in the United States and makes up about 30% of all lymphomas. Although it is aggressive, it is one of the most curable types of lymphomas, and the regimen that's generally used is a combination of the antibody rituximab along with CHOP chemotherapy. The number of cycles and whether or not radiation is used along with it depends on the staging. There are also aggressive lymphomas that are derived from T cells, and peripheral T cell lymphoma is a particular type of lymphoma, and those lymphomas are often also treated with the CHOP regimen, but not with rituximab, since that antibody works only with B-cell lymphomas. There are a lot of problems with treating T-cell lymphomas, and so my colleague, Dr. O'Connor, will talk about several exciting new drugs that may be better than the standard of care for that disease. The third type I'll describe is follicular lymphoma, a very common type. It makes up about 25% of all lymphomas, and it's the prototype for slow-growing or indolent lymphomas. Other slow-growing lymphomas are also treated similarly, that is, small lymphocytic lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma, lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma. And since these lymphomas grow very slowly and are often asymptomatic, a lot of times, patients are merely observed for a period of time, often several years, without any treatment at all. And so watchful waiting or observation is an acceptable strategy for some patients with these indolent lymphomas. Alternatively, patients can be treated with rituximab as a single drug, and either a short course of therapy can be given, that is weekly for 4 weeks, or more commonly these days, maintenance therapy is given with a dose of antibody every 2 to 3 months for 2 years. Alternatively, if the patient has more symptoms or bulky disease, we tend to use rituximab antibody along with chemotherapy, and there are several good accepted regimens, RCVP, RCHOP, R with bendamustine, and those are all very effective regimens. The fourth lymphoma type I'll describe is mantle cell lymphoma, which makes up about 6% of all lymphomas. It typically is in men in their 50s to 70s and is a very controversial type. I think the experts don't all agree on the best approach for this disease. Usually it's treated with the antibody rituximab along with chemotherapy, and the chemo regimens that are generally used are CHOP, an aggressive regimen called Hypercivad, or nowadays bendamustine. And at many centers, that chemotherapy is then followed up with an autologous stem cell transplant. The fifth and last type of lymphoma I'll describe is Hodgkin lymphoma, and there are over 8,000 cases a year in the United States. And treatment for this disease is usually with a four-drug chemo regimen called ABVD. And early-stage patients usually get 2 to 4 cycles followed by radiation, whereas patients with 3 to 4 disease, stage 3 and 4, usually get 6 cycles of ABVD, or in some countries such as Germany, they use a newer, more intense regimen called Biocop. So I think the message I would like to end up with is that treatment is definitely better for virtually every kind of lymphoma that I've described. And this is because we have new tests that help us, like PET scans, new drugs in the last decade, like rituximab, bendamustine, radioimmunotherapy, new applications, that is using maintenance rituximab, new approaches like mini transplants, and we have less toxicity in some cases. For example, in early stage Hodgkin's, we're using less radiation and fewer cycles of chemo. But all these advances have only been made possible by participation of patients on clinical trials. And I think it's important for patients to realize that the outcome and survival of patients who participate in trials is generally better than those that don't. There are generally three phases of trials when a new drug is being tested. In phase one trials, doctors try to determine the best dose of the drug to use. And then there's a phase two trial in which the best dose is then used and response rates and toxicities are documented. And finally, phase 3 trials are the definitive trials. These are generally randomized trials with large numbers of patients, and half the patients get the new treatment, and half the patients get the standard of care treatment. And this is really the only way we can prove without a doubt that the new treatment is better than the standard of care, and then the new treatment becomes the new standard of care. So I think it's very important to realize the importance of clinical trials. It's the only way we make advances, and we're very grateful to patients who help us to improve the outcome of patients with lymphoma. So I'm going to end at this point and turn the program back over to my colleagues.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Press, for an excellent overview of lymphoma and really setting the stage for the program today. Thank you. I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Pharmacology, Deputy Cancer Center Director, New York University Cancer Institute, Chief Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, NYU Langone Medical Center. As you can see, also, Dr. O'Connor wears many hats, and he, on today's program, is going to talk about T-cell lymphoma and the updates from ASH. Dr. O'Connor?
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and hello to everybody. Thank you very much for joining the call today. So one of the things you heard Dr. Press talk about a short while ago was some of the developments in T-cell lymphoma. And the peripheral T-cell lymphomas represent a relatively small fraction of all cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In fact, only about 10 to 15% of all patients with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma have a T-cell lymphoma. So the overwhelming majority of patients with lymphoma, in fact, have a B-cell lymphoma. One of the interesting features of this disease is that over the years we've learned that many different kinds of conventional chemotherapy regimens, like the CHOP regimen that Dr. Press mentioned, have really inferior results. They don't help all the patients that we want to help with these particular diseases. So there's really a need to try to identify new drugs with unique activity in the T-cell lymphomas. And over the years, because this is a relatively new entity that's been described, many of the drugs that we've had for T-cell lymphoma are basically brought over from our experiences in B-cell lymphoma. And it's not until very recently that we've actually been able to identify drugs with unique activity in these diseases. I think many of the controversies in the management of T-cell lymphoma are really highlighted best by looking at the recommendations of our colleagues at the NCCN, where they've actually recommended that whether you're a patient with T-cell lymphoma just diagnosed or a patient with relapsed disease, enrollment in a clinical trial is the recommended choice of care for all these patients. Interestingly, at ASH, there were a number of new updates regarding some drugs that we know have activity in T-cell lymphoma and some very exciting new data about new molecules that really took us by surprise as having very interesting activity that was found, as Dr. Press alluded to a moment ago, on clinical trial. One of those new drugs was a drug called romidepsin. And romidepsin belongs to a new class of molecules known as histone deacetylase inhibitors. Many of you may be aware of this class of new drugs, the HDAC inhibitors they're sometimes referred to as. One of those drugs, vorinostat, has been approved in the past for patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, that is, T-cell lymphomas that primarily involve the skin. And we've known over the last 5 years that these drugs do have activity in the disease, and strangely, they appear to have activity in T-cell lymphoma, but not a lot to date in the B-cell lymphomas. But Dr. Coiffier from Paris actually conducted a pivotal clinical trial, phase 2 clinical trial, of romidepsin in patients with relapsed or refractory peripheral T-cell lymphoma. And he gave a very interesting presentation where he talked about 130 patients that had a confirmed diagnosis of this disease. And on that clinical trial, the overall response rate, based upon a review of all the data by an independent review committee, was 26%, with about 15% of patients having a complete remission and a median time to response of only about 3 or 4 months or so. So this trial actually comes on the heels of some previous experiences that have been documented by the National Cancer Institute, where they had a similar experience demonstrating that as a single agent, in patients who have not responded well to 3 or 6 or 9 different conventional chemotherapy drugs, they were able to achieve very, very clinically significant responses in this patient population. And those responses in the trial reported by the National Cancer Institute have been reported to last for as long as a year. So right now, this class of drugs are being studied, and there are other forms of HDAC inhibitors that are being studied, including belinostat and panobinostat. And I think this data that I just told you about is going to make its way to the regulatory agencies both in the United States and Europe, and will hopefully lead to the approval of this drug in peripheral T-cell lymphoma. Interestingly, romidepsin was approved only about late last November for the treatment of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. One of our colleagues, Dr. Widzig, presented results on a phase 2 clinical trial of a drug called tipifarnib. And tipifarnib is an older drug that had been studied for years in the treatment of patients with acute myelogenous leukemia, or AML. The drug didn't really succeed well in those clinical trials, but a study of this agent in T-cell lymphoma, and there's a very strong rationale for thinking why this agent might have effect, has actually demonstrated some surprising activity. When Dr. Widzig looked at all the patients with lymphoma that were treated in his trial, the response rate was 20%. So he actually treated 93 patients, 12 of whom had a 19 of whom actually had a clinical response. But when he looked at the 19 responders, it turned out that there were only 7 patients on the trial that had T-cell lymphoma, and 7 of those 19 responders, in fact, had T-cell lymphoma. Most of them had peripheral T-cell lymphoma. When they actually looked at how long the benefit lasted, these patients had a duration of benefit of about 8 months or so on that clinical trial. The drug overall was very, very well tolerated. And this is actually a perfect example of what Dr. Press just closed his comments with, and that is that clinical trial and enrollment in a clinical trial can be a very, very meaningful form of therapy. And in fact, if they didn't do that trial and if patients didn't enroll in that trial, we would never have learned that this drug has this kind of activity in this population. And now these observations are going to lead to a lot of new clinical trials looking at tipifarnib in T-cell lymphoma. And in similar fashion, our colleagues out in Omaha presented a phase 1-2 study of a drug called dasatinib in patients with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They didn't care if you had B-cell lymphoma or T-cell lymphoma. They simply treated all patients with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They treated a small number of patients, only about 27, 14 of them on the phase 1 part, 13 on the phase 2 part, and they actually found that a dose of about 150 milligrams a day of the drug had very, very significant activity. So dasatinib is actually a drug that's already used in the treatment of certain kinds of leukemia, namely chronic myelogenous leukemia, or CML. And there's really, again, strong rationale for thinking why it might have activity in certain subtypes of lymphoma. But again, the overall response rate was 32%, including 2 patients that had complete remission. And it turns out that when you look at all the patients that were enrolled on the clinical trial, both of the complete remissions actually happened in patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma. And to date, those responses have lasted for over 2 years. So this is an oral drug predominantly being studied in patients who have not responded well to conventional chemotherapy. They take this oral medicine. 2 of them have had a complete remission lasting more than 2 years, and 1 has had a partial remission. Again, a very well-tolerated drug that has some modest effects on the bone marrow. Well, in addition to some of those new molecules, there were some interesting updates regarding another drug that was actually approved last November by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration called pralatrexate. And that's a drug that had been developed by myself and my colleagues both at Sloan Kettering and Columbia over the last several years. And it's a drug that was approved in November by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration because it produced responses in very heavily treated patients of about 30%, and those responses on average lasted about 10 months. Well, Andrei Shustov from the Fred Hutch actually presented a trial looking at all the patients, or he presented data, looking at all those patients on that international registration-directed study, and he looked at those patients who received pralatrexate immediately after CHOP chemotherapy. So these are patients that received the drug very, very early in the course of their disease, and he actually found that the overall response rate when you gave the drug earlier was 47%. So that substantially increased from the 29% when you give it to patients that have had many, many, many different lines of chemotherapy. And it really goes to the point that when you think about clinical trials, thinking about enrollment and treatment on a trial earlier, not later, may actually have some advantage. He showed that in this patient population, The median duration of response was, again, about 8 or 9 months in this particular patient population. And he also demonstrated that the use of pralatrexate in these patients earlier allowed the physicians to achieve complete remissions in select patients, and those complete remissions bridged those patients to a definitive autologous stem cell transplant. And now, 2 years later, despite having not responded well to CHOP chemotherapy, these patients are in complete remission 2 years following the stem cell transplant. Some additional data presented by Dr. Gua also illuminated essentially the same thing, but in this case, he looked at all those patients on PROPEL that had received pralatrexate immediately after ICE-based chemotherapy, and he could actually demonstrate that, again, moving the drug earlier on for those patients treated on the clinical trial resulted in a response rate about 10% higher than what it was on the entire patient population, suggesting that enrollment in clinical trial and being treated earlier on these trials may be more advantageous than waiting until you've seen many, many different lines of chemotherapy. Finally, a study presented by Dr. Horowitz, just as romidepsin had been approved in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and is now being studied in patients with peripheral T-cell lymphoma, Dr. Horowitz has led a study of pralatrexate in patients with CTCL lymphoma, and he took a different approach. He actually said, this is a chronic disease, and I want to find a dose of this drug that's well tolerated by patients so they can take it for a long time. So he actually identified a dose of the drug that was very well tolerated in these patients. He treated over 54 patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma that had seen and relapsed following many, many different lines of conventional chemotherapy. And in this patient population, he showed an overall response rate of about 50% in those patients getting more than 15 milligrams per meter squared. And when he looked at the entire patient population, irrespective of the dose, it was actually 43%. So he also demonstrated that the drug was well tolerated, had a toxicity profile that predominantly included effects on your bone marrow and some fatigue. But now this is going to form the basis for a very large international randomized clinical trial being conducted in North America and in Europe in patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. So I think, as you can hopefully perceive from the tone of my voice, there's a lot of excitement now in the development of many of these new drugs. And as you might expect, these drugs are now going to be studied in combination with the hope that we can identify better platforms of treatment for patients with T-cell lymphoma, platforms that hopefully produce much better outcomes compared to the traditional conventional platforms that we're using today. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention and turn it back to my colleagues.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor, for just a wonderful presentation and wonderful updates. Everybody really will have questions for you about during the Q&A, but just really very excellent updates for everyone to hear about. Our next speaker is Dr. Bruce Chesson. Dr. Chesson is professor of medicine, head of hematology, Georgetown University Hospital, and Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Chesson is going to address a B-cell non-Hodgkin's and Hodgkin's lymphoma. Dr. Chesson?
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here and to speak with my two friends and colleagues who you've heard previously. Dr. Press did a wonderful job of setting the stage, and he described to you that diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is the most common of the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, accounting for about 35% of patients. And for the last 8 years, the standard therapy has been R-CHOP, a combination of rituximab with a four-drug chemotherapy regimen. And this results in a cure rate of around 60%, varying on patient risk, what's called the International Prognostic Index. And there have been a number of attempts to challenge this regimen. The Germans have given R-CHOP every 2 weeks instead of every 3 weeks and thought that they were doing better. However, two other large studies, one from England and one from a French-Belgian group called the Gila Group, failed to confirm this impression. So we've tried to improve on R-CHOP in a number of ways. At these meetings, we presented an update of a U.S. intergroup trial in which patients with R-CHOP as their therapy were randomly allocated to maintenance rituximab or observation. And unfortunately, there was no demonstrated benefit from the addition of rituximab to R-CHOP as a maintenance approach. Now, There have been some other studies. There was one from the Southwest Oncology Group looking at R-CHOP followed by radioimmunotherapy, a drug called HI-131 tocilizumab or Bexxar, and again, unfortunately, in advanced stage patients, there was no additional benefit. So the bottom line is that R-CHOP given every 21 days remains the standard therapy. Now, patients with follicular and other low-grade lymphomas are usually highly responsive to treatment, yet these remain incurable diseases. Largely as a result of the availability of active and well-tolerated biological therapies, notably rituximab, survival has been prolonged. Nevertheless, there are some patients who are asymptomatic and do not have extensive or bulky disease, are often managed in a watch-and-wait fashion. This was based on early studies using drugs like chlorambucil or CVP chemotherapy, suggesting no benefit for early treatment versus delayed treatment. At these meetings, this paradigm was challenged by Ardeshna and his coworkers, who conducted a three-arm randomized trial in which patients with stages 2 to 4 asymptomatic non-bulky follicular lymphoma were randomized to either watch and wait, weekly rituximab for 4 doses, or weekly rituximab for 4 doses followed by maintenance. They concluded that the time to next treatment was longer if you got early intervention with rituximab. However, they were not able to show any improvement in survival or quality of life or any other features, and patients are being subjected to therapy, which does have cost and does have some adverse effects. So I think it remains that watch and wait is a viable option, although longer follow-up of this early intervention with rituximab approach may, in the long run, demonstrate some benefit, but we need many years of follow-up to show this. Now, since follicular lymphoma is a disease characterized by repeated relapses, new agents are warranted. Recent clinical research has focused on novel targeted agents, not only monoclonal antibodies, but others that target pathways within the lymphoma cell that are needed for the survival and longevity of these cancer cells. There are a couple of very, very exciting drugs in the clinic. One of these is CAL-101, which targets a pathway called PI3 kinase. It's an oral drug. And in indolent lymphomas, the response rate has been 62%, the same in mantle cell lymphoma, although lower in large cell lymphoma. And at the ASH meetings, my former fellow Nathan Fowler updated their work with another oral agent called Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor. The drug is called PCI-32765, but this BTK, or Bruton's tyrosine kinase, is another part of a pathway which leads to the longevity of the cancer cell. And this drug blocks that pathway. And they reported a 60% response rate in CLL/SLL, a 75% response rate in mantle cell lymphoma, 25% in follicular, and 38% in large cell, for an overall response rate of 43% and virtually no toxicity from this oral drug. Now, you all know about monoclonal antibodies because rituximab has been around for such a long time. There are other monoclonal antibodies that have been evaluated, but there are also ways that investigators have tried to improve on the efficacy of an antibody. One of these is a drug-antibody conjugate, in which an antibody is linked to a toxin. And because it's linked to this antibody, it goes directly to the lymphoma cells, it's internalized by these cells, and kills them. One such agent presented at ASH was inotuzumab. And this binds an antibody directed against CD22, rituximab is against CD20, and this is hooked to a toxin called calicheamycin. And Gua and his coworkers presented data on 43 patients with indolent lymphoma and reported a response rate of 53% in relapsed and refractory patients and 66% response rate in those with follicular lymphoma. A number of clinical trials are in development featuring combinations with these drugs. Now, one of my hats is chairman of the Lymphoma Committee of the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, an NCI-funded cooperative group. And what we have done is we have taken the concept that there are a number of patients with untreated follicular lymphoma that neither need nor want chemotherapy, and that rituximab by itself is not adequate. So what we have done is we have developed doublets of biological agents in previously untreated patients. That means two biological drugs together with no chemotherapy. At the ASH meetings, our most recent study was presented by Barbara Grant and her coworkers within our group, and we combined rituximab and an anti-CD22 antibody called eprituzumab. The overall response rate was almost 85%, and a third of the patients had a complete remission. Not a single patient who achieved a complete remission has relapsed as of the present time. We are now doing a combination of rituximab and Revlimid or lenalidomide, and this is based on some preliminary data which suggests that this combination in previously untreated patients can induce responses in almost 90%, and this regimen is extremely well tolerated. Now, Hodgkin's lymphoma has been the poster child for progress in cancer. Several decades ago, it was a uniformly fatal disease, and now we're curing over 80% of patients, and with early stage disease, over 90% of patients. And we do this with a combination regimen called ABVD. And this was developed in the 1970s by Dr. Bonadonna and his coworkers in Italy. And after a series of clinical trials showed that ABVD was at least as good as other therapies with less toxicity, it became the standard. At Stanford University in California, they developed a regimen called Stanford 5. And the premise of this was the chemotherapies were given more rapidly and in a condensed fashion. So instead of 6 months of ABVD, this was given 12 weeks. But it has to be followed by very carefully administered radiation therapy. And their single institution data were very exciting, but required confirmation and required a comparison with ABVD. And there were two studies presented at ASH, one by Leo Gordon and one by Ranjana Advani, both from the same study, in which an Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, Cancer and Leukemia Group B, and Southwest Oncology Group collaborative effort compared Stanford 5 with ABVD, both followed by radiation in appropriate patients. And unfortunately, ABVD remains the standard. There was no benefit from the Stanford 5 in the patient population as a whole or in patients who had bulky mediastinal disease. As you've heard, there are some data from Germany suggesting that the Biocop regimen might be advantageous, but this is also associated with considerably more morbidity and secondary malignancies. It's also not clear that all the drugs in ABVD are needed, and some data that are not yet published suggest that bleomycin may not be a drug that is sufficiently effective to maintain in this combination. And what are we going to do about that? Are we going to replace it with something? Well, some of the excitement of new drugs in Hodgkin's lymphoma was presented at the ASH meetings. There were two drugs of particular note. One was called panobinostat, which Dr. O'Connor mentioned is effective in T-cell lymphoma, but there were data presented at ASH from Sereda and her coworkers, suggesting that this oral drug, a histone deacetylase inhibitor, when given to patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma who had failed an autologous stem cell transplant, was associated with a response rate of 27%. And some of these were durable, and the drug was well tolerated. But clearly, the greatest excitement was generated by a drug called brentuximab vedotin, or SGN-35. SGN-35 is another drug antibody conjugate in which the monoclonal antibody SGN-30, which is an anti-CD30 monoclonal antibody, is combined with a drug that paralyzes the ability of cancer cells to divide, a drug called auristatin. And what they showed in this very heavily pretreated patients, most of whom had failed a stem cell transplant, the response rate was 75%, and some of these were quite durable. This is unheard of in new drug development in Hodgkin's lymphoma. And in fact, the activity is not restricted to Hodgkin's lymphoma, but there is another form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma called anaplastic large cell lymphoma, ALCL, which also expresses this CD30 antigen. And at these meetings, a study was presented using SGN-30 in ALCL, and the response rate was a startling 86%. And these patients had failed multiple prior regimens, and most of these responses were complete remissions. So these are very exciting new drugs. Now, there are two things we need to do in Hodgkin's lymphoma since we are curing so many patients. One is to improve the efficacy in patients who are at high risk, and that's where some of these new drugs come in. And the other is to potentially reduce the amount of therapy in patients who are in a lower risk group. And one way to do this that is being explored in a number of studies around the country and around the world is using a PET scan after a couple of cycles of treatment. And at the ASH meetings, the German Hodgkin's study group did a trial in which they were comparing several different permutations of their BIACOP program. But in patients who had a residual mass of 2.5 centimeters or larger, if they were PET negative, they didn't have any further treatment. If they were PET positive, they had radiation treatment. And what they showed was that they were able to reduce the number of patients who got radiated in their clinical trials from 70%, 70, in earlier studies, now down to only 11% of patients who now received radiation therapy. You've heard of the importance already of clinical trials. We do have three trials in the country right now that are looking at this sort of risk-adapted approach. Dr. Press is the principal investigator on an intergroup study for patients with advanced stage disease. And in the CLGB, we have two other studies, one for patients with limited stage disease and another for patients with early stage bulky disease with the same concept. Two courses of chemotherapy, a PET scan, and the further treatment dependent on the results of that PET scan. So whereas a PET scan should not be standard therapy after several cycles of treatment, we are now looking at its potential within the setting of a clinical trial. The goal, again, is to minimize therapy in early stage patients who may not need more treatment and to enhance therapy for those at high risk of recurrence. So those are some of the more exciting non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma studies and Hodgkin's lymphoma studies that were presented at the ASH meetings. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chesson, for those really exciting updates that everybody heard, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Brian Tomlinson. Brian also is responsible for the program today. In many ways, he is the person who has actually helped to get us the support for the program today. And he is really, he's been remarkable in just helping to identify the speakers and obtain the funding. And I should say that Brian actually has a new title, and he is the Chief Program Officer at the Lymphoma Research Foundation. So I now turn the program over to Brian.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you again to you and your colleagues at Cancer Care for just a wonderful partnership on this call and all of the calls that we present for people affected by lymphoma throughout the year. And on behalf of the LRF, I welcome all of you to the call today. By far, this is the largest call we've ever hosted, so we're certainly pleased that you found it and hope that you found the presentations informative. I'd like to thank our esteemed faculty, Drs. Chesson, O'Connor, and Press, for taking time to be with us today and for all that they do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and for all people affected by the disease. These three individuals volunteer countless hours of their time to participate in our educational programs, to serve on our scientific advisory boards, as well as a number of other activities. So we really do thank them on behalf of the organization for all that they do for us. And lastly, I would like to acknowledge the supporters of today's call, Cephalon Oncology, Genentech, Biogen IDEC, and Millennium, the Takeda Oncology Company. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding innovative research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, the organization has funded over $42.5 million in lymphoma-specific research, and more than 35,000 people participate in our programs and services each year. The organization provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for all of you on the phone and for all people affected by lymphoma and their loved ones. Some of these programs include our Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional public health and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information about lymphoma and connect you with appropriate resources. On today's call, you all heard a lot about clinical trials, and we do offer a clinical trials information service where a member of our Helpline team can assist you in your search for clinical trials. We have a nationwide lymphoma support network, which is a one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. We have a variety of publications and newsletters that include our comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, and informational e-newsletters. A number of webcasts and podcasts that are available on specific types of lymphoma, as well as treatment options and support issues, available on our website at lymphoma.org, and a variety of in-person patient conferences on the local, regional, and national levels. For more information about the foundation or any of the programs I just mentioned, please contact a member of our Lymphoma Helpline team by calling us at 1-800-500-9976 or visiting us on the Internet at lymphoma.org. Again, thank you to Carolyn, Cancer Care, our faculty, and the supporters of today's call.
Thank you so much, Brian. And it's really, I have to say, it's a great pleasure to work with the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Brian in really making these programs possible for everybody. So thank you. Our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Rick is a oncology social worker. He's blood cancers program coordinator, mind-body project coordinator, Cancer Care. And Rick is going to tell you a few things about the services of Cancer Care.
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the expert advice of Drs. O'Connor, Press, and Chesson. Thank you very much. And collaborating with Lymphoma Research Foundation is always very rewarding for me and Cancer Care. Most people don't realize their oncology care is handled by a healthcare team, which includes their doctor, an oncology nurse and social worker, and often a physical therapist, billing representative, and other specialists. They are all working together to coordinate your care. The nurse and social worker are knowledgeable about your treatment plan and can offer expert advice or guide you to someone who can when your doctor is not available. For lymphoma patients, there are numerous issues which can impact your lives. Concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will take care of loved ones when you are in treatment are common questions. At some point, the whole process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with your healthcare team are so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. During these times, it is often helpful for patients and loved ones to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional. At Cancer Care, along with these Connect workshops, we offer limited financial assistance, helpful fact sheets on resources and cancer-related topics, podcasts of archived workshops, as well as counseling and support groups run by oncology social workers. Nationally, we also offer telephone and online support groups to patients and those who care about them. To many, like yourself, support groups and social supports can go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE or online at www.cancercare.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rick, for really describing the services that people can access for free. And now we have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring on all of our speakers, and if you would explain to the audience, Mary, how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, with so many of you on the call, if we don't get to your question, please call the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care for follow-up in terms of help with your questions. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Donald M.
Thank you very much. I have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, mantle cell. I had it for a long time, and I've taken Rituxan, and I have a extensive peripheral neuropathy in my legs. I can hardly walk, and that's a result of thalidomide and Revlimid. And as is inevitable, the disease is back, and I have to be treated again.
And your question, Donald?
My question is there some drug I can take that will not make my peripheral neuropathy worse and keep me from walking?
Okay. Well, excellent question, Donald, and I want to thank you for asking it. There are a lot of different parts to it, and I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question in a general way. I'm going to ask Dr. Press and Dr. Chesson if you could address this question in a general way so everyone in the audience could have some help with it.
Sure. Well, there are many. I'll begin by just saying there are many different regimens that can be used for mantle cell lymphoma, and I don't know all the things that you've had. But there are a lot of chemotherapy agents that don't cause neuropathy and which could be used. Many of the drugs we talked about today in the clinical trials have a lot of activity in mantle cell lymphoma, Cal-101, the BTK inhibitor, et cetera. Lenalidomide, I guess, is a possibility, which is already on the market. I think some of the antibodies that were talked about might be appropriate, epertuzumab, et cetera. Bruce, do you want to add some thoughts there?
Sure. I think the best drug is still hasn't been mentioned. That's bendamustine.
Yeah, I was just thinking as I...
When you think of me, you think of bendamustine, right?
Yeah.
Well, bendamustine is a drug that's been around for about 40 years, but was recently approved only about less than 2 years ago by the FDA. For CLL and also for relapsed refractory follicular and low-grade lymphoma, refractory to rituximab. But in a paper that we published a couple of years ago in patients who had failed other therapies, the response rate to rituximab and bendamustine was 92% in mantle cell lymphoma with an average time to progression of about 2 years. So those results are so exciting that we are now studying bendamustine rituximab as the initial treatment for mantle cell lymphoma. And in fact, in a German study chaired by Matthias Rummel, he compared R-CHOP with R-bendamustine as the initial treatment with mantle cell lymphoma, as well as other forms of indolent lymphomas. And R-bendamustine was superior in complete response rate and time to disease progression and was significantly less toxic. And there are virtually no neurological complications of bendamustine. We've encountered one at our institution, but that's out of thousands of patients that have been treated with this drug.
And Because there's a part of Donald's question, thank you very much, both of you, for that excellent answers, and I hope that's helpful to you, Donald. But there is the other issue, and I think it may be an issue for many people on the call, about the peripheral neuropathy. Could any of our speakers want to just address that as a general topic in terms of, I know it could be a whole, we have done this at their own teleconference, but just to give some guidance in terms of how people can get some help with that or what to think about.
Well, the peripheral neuropathy is an unfortunate complication of a lot of chemotherapy drugs, particularly the vinca alkaloids. Those are vincristine and vinblastine, but also some other drugs in solid tumors, the platinum analogs, et cetera. It is very important for patients who are undergoing treatment, if they experience numbness and tingling in fingers or toes, to report this to their doctor as soon as possible, because the dose of that particular agent should be either curtailed or the drug should be discontinued altogether. There aren't great treatments for this. We have a concoction of B vitamins that works in some patients, but in general we usually resort to such drugs as Lyrica and related drugs like that. Some patients will respond and some get better over time, but unfortunately in some cases it's not reversible.
Elidil is a good drug. It takes a long time to work, and it's a medicine that helps you sometimes sleep at night. So we found that it doesn't take it doesn't act quickly. It takes about 2 to 3 months, maybe 4 in some cases, to work. But taking a low dose of that before you go to bed is a simple, easy thing to do. And then after a few months, we've seen a significant number of patients derive merit from that approach.
The other drug is Neurontin that could be used.
Right, gabapentin.
Excellent. Okay, I hope that's all helpful to everyone. Now, our next question, please. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Gary G.
Yes, thank you. Excellent presentation. Thank you. You didn't cover one question I am surprised by, that the incidence of NHL is increasing by at least double-fold over the past couple decades, and no one seems to have any reason why. Has that been explored at ASH or lately?
Well, thank you for that question.
There are many reasons for that. I guess first of all, I would say there are some suggestions that rise is slowing down or plateauing in the last year or two on the latest statistics. But it is true that for at least 40 years, there's been a progressive increase, and it's partly probably due to exposure to chemicals, carcinogens, such particularly pesticides and insecticides and herbicides have been implicated. There's much increased risk in people who are immunosuppressed or on immunosuppressive drugs, like liver transplant patients or patients with AIDS. And since we have a lot more immunodeficient patients now, that partly explains it. And then lymphoma is more common in people as they get older, and since our population is aging, that's another part of the explanation. But even if you account for all three of those things, there still had been an excess incidence that's partly unexplained.
Thank you. And Gary, thank you for that excellent question, and we hope to be able to explain it in future calls. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Elaine S.
Thank you. With someone who has marginal zone NHL, has been treated and then followed up with Rituxan twice a year for 2 years, if it should come back based on the latest research, what would be the standard protocol now to treat it with?
Thank you for that question, Elaine, and I'm going to ask, again, our speakers to address your question in a general way.
What's the location of the marginal zone lymphoma? There are several classes of marginal zone lymphoma, several kinds. One is primarily in the lymph nodes. Another is primarily in other sites, particularly the stomach, the eye, and others. And some just primarily involves the spleen. And they're treated somewhat differently. So what site are we talking about?
I think a general answer would be that there's a lot of therapies that are available, and these therapies are actually titrated to the aggressiveness of the disease. So for patients who might have very slow-growing, indolent-behaving disease, one would not use very aggressive chemotherapies. But for those patients that have more aggressive disease that's producing symptoms, then obviously some form of chemotherapy or combination chemotherapy may be reasonable. Again, this is one of those diseases where there's probably a number of clinical trials if you're near an academic center where many of the new drugs may be just as valuable as some of the older ones and potentially carry a little bit less toxicity. But it's one of those therapies where usually it's one of those diseases where the therapy is tailored for the patient depending upon the types of comorbidities that they carry as well as some understanding of the natural history and aggressiveness of the disease. But it is a disease for which we have many, many, many treatment options beyond simple rituximab.
And one that hasn't been mentioned yet is radioimmunotherapy, mm-hmm. which is an antibody linked to a radioisotope, and there are two of these that are now commercially available. And Dr. Press has done a lot of development of these drugs. And these are quite effective in relapsed and refractory indolent lymphomas, such as marginal zone lymphoma.
And bendamustine would be another good drug in that situation, too.
Absolutely.
So, Elaine, I hope this has been helpful, and you can see the benefit of having a multidisciplinary group of physicians really thinking about what's best for you. This is really a really your role. All the physicians here are role modeling really excellent. You know how they think through best treatments. So, next question, please.
Our next question comes from Judy R.
Yes, nice. He has mantle cell, and he's on a clinical trial for Velcade. Have they found any results of that? And it was very exciting to hear about the possibility of the oral medication that you spoke of this morning, this afternoon, sorry, the PC-13726.
Thank you for that question.
Bruce, you want to take that?
Well, you know, Owen is certainly our maven on bortezomib.
So, again, there's a lot of details here where I don't know, which is what therapies you've been treated with previously. But in general, for mantle cell lymphoma, depending upon your age and the comorbidities you have, increasingly more and more doctors are giving patients some form of combination chemotherapy that may or may not include bortezomib, followed by an autologous stem cell transplant in what we refer to as first remission. For those patients who've relapsed after some upfront therapy getting bortezomib, either as a single agent or more commonly now in combination with Rituxan, can be a very effective therapy. But one of the side effects that we heard about earlier was neuropathy, which is a common side effect of the drug, and that can sometimes limit how much therapy you get. There are now new versions of drugs similar to bortezomib that are proteasome inhibitors, sort of the next generation. One of them is carfilzomib, which appears to have some activity in myeloma, and interestingly, not very much in the way of neuropathy. And there are new ways to give bortezomib, and there was a lot of data at ASH looking at subcutaneous administration of bortezomib, which appears to be associated with very similar efficacy, similar responses as when you get it IV, but really interestingly, much less in the way of neuropathy. So mantle cell happens to be one of those diseases where there are lots of new drugs that include bendamustine, and all of these drugs in combination, like Rituxan, bendamustine, even Rituxan, bendamustine, plus bortezomib, as well as other new generation drugs like the CAL-101 or PI3 kinase inhibitor Dr. Chesson spoke about, mTOR inhibitors like temsirolimus and everolimus or RAD-001 are also very, very active and oral and well-tolerated. So, again, I can't speak to the specific issues, but there really are a lot of exciting drugs that are out there, many of them very well-tolerated beyond bortezomib.
Another one that should be mentioned is lenalidomide or Revlimid,
yes,
which has a reported published response rate of 50% in relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma. It is associated in some patients with some neuropathy, but it's not a major complication of that particular drug, unlike its predecessor, thalidomide.
Thalidomide, yeah.
Excellent. I want to thank our speakers today. They have just been really outstanding, and they also have modeled for all of you how physicians think and work together the best, come up with the best treatment for each of you. I want to thank all of you for participating today. I want to thank all of you who have asked such wonderful questions that really enhanced our call today and allowed our speakers to then elaborate further on what they had presented. I want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour educational workshop, and such, I want to remind you all that there are many services that continue for all of you after this program ends. So although the program itself will end soon, the services that you can access from the Lymphoma Research Foundation, from Cancer Care, and all the other organizations that are listed as resources for you, those continue endlessly. And most importantly, I would not want anyone to leave this call feeling that you're alone. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. And we are simply a phone call away, or you can visit our websites, but most of our international participants, we are simply an email or website away from your getting help. So I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I want to thank you all for participating today. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.